Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Senate says no to the president's jobs plan, Herman Cain surges, and the FBI says it foiled an Iranian terror plot in Washington, D.C. Republicans and a couple of Democrats said no to the White House jobs bill. President Obama jumped on the vote.
If you're voting no against this bill, look a Pittsburgh teacher in the eye and tell them just why they don't deserve to get a paycheck again, and more importantly, be able to transmit all that knowledge to their kids.
Herman Cain keeps rising in Republican polls. Now he's number one. Here's Cain Tuesday night.
I was poor before I was poor. My dad worked three jobs. I understand what that means, but more importantly, with my career and with my record, I understand that leaders are supposed to make sure we're working on the right problems. We'll assign the right priority.
And a big alleged terror plot. Attorney General Eric Holder says Iran was behind a plan to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States in the United States.
Bob Sear is alleged to have orchestrated a $1.5 million assassination plot with Gholam Shakouri, an Iranian-based member of the Quds Force and other Iranian co-conspirators.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of the National Journal, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for the Washington Post. She was one of the questioners at Tuesday night's big GOP debate in Hanover, New Hampshire. Karen Tumulty, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
And Jack Beatty here from Hanover, New Hampshire. He was there for the debate. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Karen.
Major Garrett will join us in a moment. Jack, you were there. Karen, you were right in the thick of it. Karen, we'll come to you in a second. You were a player here. But, Jack, just step back for a second and tell us about what you saw around that round table, Charlie Rose and Karen and more. We've got these polls this week that we've got Herman Cain right out front ahead of Mitt Romney. Now, number one in GOP polling, was that evident, Jack, at the table in New Hampshire?
It certainly was. Everybody was talking about his 999 plan, including him. I think it was mentioned over 25 times. That really was the center of the debate. And he defended it, insofar as he did defend it, on the grounds of its simplicity. And that's the advantage of it. It's simple. It's easy to understand. And I thought Mitt Romney made a pretty good response when he said, yes, simple ideas are useful, but often inadequate. And that may describe 999.
Karen, what was the experience of jumping into question here? Charlie kind of moderating you, and there were some tough questions. Rush Limbaugh went after you for your questions. And somebody, what did somebody call it here in the Wall Street Journal? The ink-stained vigilante, I believe. What's it like to be right out there on the firing line in one of those, Karen?
Well, you know, it's interesting because afterward, Newt Gingrich said he thought the questionings were highly substantive and it was possibly, you know, much better than the earlier debates had been. And even Michelle Bachmann had praised the questions. So I guess that you just find yourself in the, you know, in the hot seat on these things, because my job as a moderator is to keep these candidates from just sitting there and reciting their talking points and their stump speeches, which is, of course, you know, what
sure.
they would all do. So, I guess some heat comes with the job. But again, the candidates themselves, who have done enough of this to be, you know, sort of pros at it, certainly understood what my job was and why I was there.
You've got to be tough to do that job. Here's a little sound of the new front runner in the polls. This is a Wall Street Journal NBC poll, Herman Cain, at the debate Tuesday night. This is the Bloomberg Washington Post debate where Karen was among the questioners. Here he is saying there was a big difference between the other GOP candidates and himself, and pushing here for his answer.
They want to pass what they think they can get passed rather than what we need, which is a bold solution. 999 is bold, and the American people want a bold solution, not just what's going to kick the can down the table.
A bold solution. Let's jump in on this then, Karen. What do you see in 999? And explain again once more what Herman Cain means by that.
Well, it means a 9% income tax, a 9% corporate tax, and a 9% sales tax. Now,
this is a radical overhaul of the federal tax system.
It is, and it is certainly simple, but as a number of the other candidates pointed out, you know, among them Michelle Bachmann and Rick Santorum, you know, for a lot of Americans, this would be pretty jolting. I mean, New Hampshire itself has no sales tax. So at one point, Rick Santorum turned to the audience and said, hey, anybody out there want to start paying a sales tax?
They have no state sales tax, but here, if you had 999, they would suddenly have a 9% federal sales tax, and so would everyone else in the country.
And, you know, in places like Texas, where you do have a very high sales tax, people would be paying upwards of 15% on every single thing they buy.
When you stack up the state take and then the federal 9% take, 15, wow.
That's right.
That becomes a big number. Jack, I mean, this is getting, a lot of billboard space from Herman Cain himself. But where's it come from? What would the effect be, Jack?
Well, the effect seems to be profoundly regressive. This, according to Bruce Bartlett, a Reagan administration economist. He wrote in the Times that it's a formula designed to cut taxes for the rich, increase them for the poor, raise the deficit, and do nothing for growth. In short, hard to recommend on any economic grounds. And when you look at it through I think Michelle Bachmann put it this way, the devil is in the details. Indeed, he is. When you look at what it would do for businesses, Mr. Cain would not allow business to deduct their rent or their wages, the major, elements of a budget in a business. That would be a serious problem for any business. Second, he would allow deductions for capital expenses, but only if those expenses were made on products made in America. So he was asked yesterday or the day before in New Hampshire by a voter, well, what about Apple Computer? That's made in China and Malaysia and other places. Would that be, would a business that purchased 1,000 Apple computers be able to deduct those or not? Would they be classified as a foreign good or a domestic good? And in his candid way, Herman said, I don't have any idea.
Well, that's a kind of straightforward quality, at least the way he comes across it, that people are clearly responding to in the polls. Karen, I mean, Herman Cain was co-chairman all the way back in 1996 of the presidential campaign, ill-fated, it turns out, but of Steve Forbes, who, of course, advocated very strongly a flat tax. Is this kind of son of flat tax what we're talking about here?
Well, actually, he himself has acknowledged that 999 would actually be a transition to the so-called fair tax, which would essentially be a consumption tax, which, again—
This was Huckabee's line.
Right. Mm-hmm. And as Jack noted, it's a very regressive tax. Its proponents say, but it would encourage savings and investment. But again, at this moment that the economy is in, a lot of economists will say, well, what we need is people out there spending.
What do you think is really going on here? What do you think, Karen, is pushing Herman Cain to the front? You can say whatever you want about 999. Michelle Bachmann was quick to, ready to turn it upside down, make it 666 and see some hex or something going on there. But he's got the poll numbers ahead of Rick Perry, who was supposed to be the big deal, Michelle Bachmann, Mitt Romney himself. He's ahead of them all now. How do you interpret it, Karen?
Well, I really do think that's the contrast. I mean, everybody is looking, it feels like a lot of people in the Republican Party are looking for some alternative to Mitt Romney. They thought that Rick Perry was going to be that person, but he did sort of fade into the woodwork. I can tell you, frankly, as a moderator, we had all assumed that he was coming to pick a fight with Mitt Romney over health care, because the day before his campaign had put out a very tough video. And, we weren't going to get in the way of that. We actually gave him a couple of opportunities to do that, and he didn't. And asked about his economic plan, he just kept replying energy, and he's giving a speech. He was going to be giving a speech on that later in the week. But
Pittsburgh, I think, on energy. But I mean, not every state is Pennsylvania with its gas or Texas with its oil.
But they are looking – I think a lot of people who are not quite comfortable with Romney are looking for a voice that sounds clear and strong, and that is what Herman Cain sounds to many people.
Jack, how do you read the Cain surge this week?
I think Karen is right about the dynamics. It's anybody but Romney. And let's face it, he is charismatic and commanding. And I think really that you know, the objection that the tax, that 999 is regressive, that may not be as bothersome as, to some Republican voters as it might seem. I mean, there is a steady Republican meme that 47% of Americans don't pay income taxes. That's not fair. They should. Michelle Bachmann just gave a speech the other day saying that. Well, they certainly would pay under this. They'd pay 9%. Plus a 9% sales tax. And by the way, Social Security and Medicare, those would be pretty much eliminated. That would be funded somehow through this 999 system. It's really something. But meanwhile, Mitt Romney, he's unloved, but he remains right where he was in the polls. He hasn't lost ground, and he's been steadily winning what some political scientists call the invisible primary. That is, getting endorsements from key people in the party.
Biggest of all this week from Chris Christie. We'll come back and look at that and much more with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post and Jack Beatty. Major Garrett joins us in a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. No to the jobs bill, a Herman Cain surge in the GOP field. The U.S. alleges an Iran terror plot in the U.S. Karen Tumulty is with us from The Washington Post, national political correspondent there, joining us from Washington. Jack Beatty's here, and joining us as well from Washington now, Major Garrett, congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Major, thanks for making it in.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you there. Listeners,
sorry to be late.
It happens sometimes. It happens sometimes. We've been talking about Herman Cain. Let's go to our listeners, Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think?
Well, first, let me comment on the Eric Holder and the Iranian terrorist attack here in the country.
Wild story. Allegedly a plan to, kill the Saudi ambassador via Mexican drug gangs, probably in Washington, D.C., maybe in
right.
a restaurant with a lot of other people who would die, and they said, so what? But what do you make of it?
Well, I'm glad that they stopped it. But I just find that kind of amazing that it was announced just a day or two before that he was subpoenaed for all the records for the Fast and Furious about he knew about the guns going down to Mexico, and he misled Congress.
Yeah, this is the whole story of how there were agents who were in on that. They were undercover, but there's a lot of concern that too many guns went to Mexico while they were watching this whole thing.
2,000.
Yeah,
2,000 guns.
That's a lot.
Over 200 Mexicans have been killed in Attorney General Holder misled Congress.
Jerry, we'll come to Eric Holder. What about Herman Cain? What do you think?
Well, to be truthful, I've been saying all along, since I've been calling your show, that I like Herman Cain, and a lot of people on your panel laughed him off as a joke. But when the American people see what a conservative is, like Mr. Cain, who is a real conservative, you'll have people getting jobs.
Why Cain and not Romney, Jerry? Why Cain and not Romney in your case?
Well, Mr. Romney is not a real conservative. I mean, he says the right things, but you look at his record, and it's just totally opposite of what he's done in the past as governor in Massachusetts, and I'd say that they call Romney care, as they call it, is going to hurt him.
Jerry, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. Savannah, Georgia. Trey, you're on the air, Trey. What do you think?
Tom,
hi.
Love the topic. I'll tell y'all... We know Herman Cain in the South well for many years. When he speaks, whether it's in a debate or on the news, he's speaking the truth. He's talking like one of us. I'm going to get some magnets for my dented old truck and put Cain 2012 And we feel he's going to get the nomination, and he's going to win the presidency. We look forward to it.
Trey, I appreciate your call as well. Major Garrett, jump in here. Karen Tumulty was right in the thick of it Tuesday night at the big debate in New Hampshire. You've been watching all this. How do you think this plays out? Do we end up with Kane out front? Is this a phase and we're back to Romney? Or is it none of the above somehow, even at this late date, Major?
Well, it can't be none of the above. We're getting too close to Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. So the Republican caucus voting, caucus attending, and primary voting public is going to have to come to a decision in the not-too-distant future. And I think Herman Cain, when you look at his polling numbers, is definitely real. How much that reality can last will depend on two factors. Can he organize past where he's organized so far? That's a very much open question. Can he raise money? And can he withstand the inevitable scrutiny that will come? This next month will be very different than the previous month or any other previous month in his presidential candidacy. One thing I've been struck by about Herman Cain is, yes, he's an outsider, but there is an element of his history that conveys to conservatives an authenticity that Mitt Romney simply doesn't possess. Many conservatives either remember or have been reacquainted with Herman Cain questioning then-President Clinton in 1993, I believe it was, on health care. And he opposed it then, and for many conservatives, that is a moment of defining authenticity. It's not Reagan-esque like the way Reagan's nomination speech for Barry Goldwater was in 1964, but it's in that general area of questioning a policy, objecting to it, and taking a stand.
Major, how do you read
in that respect, I think that helps Herman Cain in ways that we underestimated and have underestimated for a while.
How do you read New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's endorsement of Romney this week? How does that play into the whole picture?
Well, I think it reveals two things. One, that the Romney campaign is very good at seizing an opportunity and claiming it before anybody else. Number two, Chris Christie is a small bore but important phenomenon of what he hopes will be a resurgent blue state Republicanism. And he wants to back other blue state Republicans and bring the party back into the conversation in the Northeast and parts of the country where, since 1992, Republicans simply have not fared well in presidential politics. And I think that is a key component of Christie's endorsement of Romney. Are they exactly the same temperamentally around the issues? No, but I think Christie sees within Romney a means by which to re-nationalize, if you will, the Republican Party and pull it out of its recent and more contemporary historic roots so deeply entrenched in the South and the Midwest.
Gary in Charleston, South Carolina. Gary, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question relates to Cain's continuous defense of Wall Street and the fact that Wall Street didn't cause all the economic problems. And while we did have many American economic problems, almost every economist recognizes that the keystone block that caused the collapse was the financial finagling, the derivatives and insuring derivatives and everything else. And so I'm not sure how the middle group, and especially what's happening now with Wall Street, that this defending Wall Street is going to carry with the American middle, uncommitted, conservative Republican voter.
That
I'd
is
like
so,
to ask if they, how they would address that.
That's great, Gary. It's such an active question right now. I mean, Occupy Wall Street has put it out there, but it also resonates in a much wider swath than that. It resonated in the Tea Party. Karen, you came right out at the debate, you know, asking if they still thought people, the candidates there, or the contenders, thought that somebody ought to be in jail for the Wall Street collapse. I think it was Newt Gingrich came around to talking about at least Barney Frank and maybe Chris Dodd, too, ought to see some of that time. But what about this issue of Wall Street and responsibility, how you see it playing out among the Republican contenders, Karen?
Well, it was really interesting because that, you know, that is the question I asked that seems to have gotten the whole sort of conservative talk show, alignment about, you know, sort of criticism of even asking that question. And it was interesting because both Michelle Bachmann and Newt Gingrich said, hey, you know, the who was at fault here was Washington. And, you know, it seemed to ignore a lot of the deregulation of Wall Street that had gone on in the 1990s.
ignored right there and ready to go the other way. I mean, Major, you've been looking at Occupy Wall Street and thinking about public sentiment. I mean, do these things live on separate continents here? Did the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street and the American electorate sort of hook up at some point? How do you see that whole thing resonating? You heard what they said in response to Karen's question.
Sure. I think it's a commonality of economic anxiety expressed in different ways and with a different villain. For the Tea Party, the villain is taxation, regulation. For Occupy Wall Street, to a certain degree, the villainy is that we don't manufacture as much as we used to anymore, and we have a tremendous amount of brain power in this country devoted to the mechanistic side of capitalism and making money out of the movement of money without creating well-paying jobs or building things in this country. I think broad strokes, those are the levels of concern. What I found fascinating and factually repellent about both Newt Gingrich and Michelle Bachmann's answers to Karen's question is that they want to associate only the Community Reinvestment Act with the entire real estate and economic collapse. And you simply can't blame all of that on that one government action. Remember in 1999, we repealed Glass-Steagall, which was a Depression-era law that made banking in this country, for lack of a better term, very boring. It was very constrained. Mm-hmm. You couldn't have insurance companies and banks do the same kind of securitization. All that was broken down. Three Republicans wrote that law, Tom Bliley of Virginia, Phil Gramm of Texas, and Jim Leach of Iowa. And the Clinton administration supported it, lobbied for it, and brought it into law. And that made banking very exciting. And exciting banking brought us collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps. And so you had two actions in Washington: lowering the standards for mortgages to increase home ownership, which everyone thought was a great idea, and these new created investment tools allowed by this deregulation of the banking insurance industry that allowed you to package them, sell them as global investment products.
Major,
for a while, it was great.
Yeah, so you say, but there was
then it collapsed.
And the others, but at the Republican debate, they're still saying, no, this was about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, you know.
Which is a completely one-sided, utterly partisan take on the actual history.
But I'm asking, I get it. I totally get it. And you've laid it out well. But what's resonating here? These are politicians. They're reading something. I mean, you're this last couple week or two quoting Marvin Gaye lyrics from 1971, make me want to holler. Oh, make you want to holler the way they do my life. But do you think that you've got the electorate sort of sharing that view with you, Major, seeing, feeling that we was done wrong by Wall Street and not responding to this Republican kind of defense?
Yes, I really do, and I think the caller brings up a very good point. If you are a stalwart, you could say I'm a stalwart capitalist, I believe in free enterprise, but if you say everything that Wall Street did and has done is defensible, you're going to lose touch with a wide swath of America. Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, and what used to be regarded as the silent majority.
Let's go to Dan in Boston. Dan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just listening about the debates and the rise of Mr. Kane and anybody but Romney, and as an independent voter, I think there's about 9.1% people of the unemployed here in this country that are tired of charisma. We've had charisma for 3 years. Mitt Romney, like him or hate him, he's created value. He's run companies. He was called in to save the U.S. Olympics. Just put somebody in there who can actually do a job. I could care less if it's Stephen Wright up there doing becoming president. I could care less about charisma. We want people who can actually do the job. Independent, Republican, Democrat, forget the charisma, you know, forget the rise in polls. Put someone up there who can actually create value in government and create value as far as the economy goes.
Yeah, forget the charisma. We've got it.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
You know,
Karen?
It's funny, Dan's point. A Republican strategist I was talking to this week was saying he's somebody not aligned with any of the campaigns, was saying of Romney, it's looking like this guy's going to win the Indy 500 driving 35 miles an hour and just not running into the guardrails. So he's got this. I think that's exactly his strategy, is to sort of, he's trying to sell uncharismatic depth. And that was certainly obvious at the debate, where he had this argument with Herman Cain about that just some problems are complex. They just aren't simple to solve.
Nothing simple about it. We're looking at a big week in the news. Nothing simple for the president and his jobs bill this week. Of course, nobody thought it would sail right through, and it certainly did not. Republicans unanimous in the Senate saying no to this. A couple of Democrats facing re-election in there against it as well. Here's Harry Reid on the floor of the Senate before the vote. This is the Democratic Majority Leader. Now, he ended up voting against it as well, but for procedural reasons, as I understand it, so he could bring it back maybe later. He's saying here a lot of ideas in here Republicans, he said, had supported in the past.
Republicans oppose those ideas now, I guess, because they have a proven track record of creating jobs, all of these programs. But I guess Republicans think if the economy improves, it might help President Obama. So they root for the economy to fail and oppose every effort to improve it.
Root for the economy to fail. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell condemning the jobs plan on the floor of the Senate before the vote that killed the bill.
Everyone who votes for this second stimulus will have to answer a simple but important question. Why on earth would you support an approach that we already know will not work?
And here's Democratic West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. He voted for the jobs bill to advance, but talked about his deep concerns about the increased spending that that plan would have entailed.
Well, I applaud the president's focus on job creation, investing in infrastructure, and making our tax system more fair by eliminating corporate giveaways. I have serious questions about the level of spending that President Obama proposed, as well as the actual effectiveness of some of these policies we'll have when it comes to creating jobs and restoring confidence in our economy.
Major Garrett, do you expect to see significant elements of the jobs bill, the pass this bill of the president, come back to Congress and be passed? Is this wholesale gone and behind us? Is it just a campaign point now?
It's all of those things. And if I were to make a prediction, and I'm not actually paid to do so, but you've invited me to do so, so let me give you this prediction. About a third of the president's plan will across the finish line legislatively. A payroll tax, either extending the one existing or possibly enlarging it a little bit, with an important side note that that's not financed and it won't be financed, which means downstream, Social Security will have less to call upon because you're eating away at a payroll tax system that provides financing for future benefits. That's a point that Washington simply refuses to take heed of, but it's going to, I think, go down that line. I think there'll be something on infrastructure. I think the interesting part of the debate will be whether Charles Schumer, New York Democrat, can persuade Republicans in the White House to take this $1 trillion that's in corporate revenue offshore that's not repatriated because the corporations don't want to pay a 35% rate, lower that rate to something like 5%, and then build an infrastructure bank to find another means of financing infrastructure construction because there's no consensus in Washington to raise the principal means by which we fund that, which is the gasoline tax. That's going to be an interesting debate. And then there'll be an extension of unemployment insurance benefits because there simply has to be. It's a crying shame. It's a terrible reality economically in this country that 4 million Americans have been out of work. 6 million Americans, rather, have been out of work for more than 6 months. 4 million, almost as much as a year. And their benefits will soon expire. And those who have just gone the unemployment lines are also facing that. So there'll be an extension of that. Those are the three components I think will survive.
Karen, what do you see on the other side of this rejection of the jobs bill wholesale?
Well, I do think it puts all the more pressure on the super committee, which is going to be coming up with its recommendations in November. Congress is going to be voting on them in December, and we are, you know, once again at the brink politically and economically, which is beginning to feel like a familiar place to be this year. And you know, the fact that all of this is going to be happening right in the middle of the Christmas shopping season, I think is sort of terrifying.
Jack, there's the talk of the Republicans wanting to just put off big moves until after the election, let the economy dangle there and the president dangle with it. Do you think they've given him an effective campaign weapon by walking away from this? Or does he suffer along with the rest?
He suffers, but you can't blink the 14% job approval rating for Congress. That's got to get their attention, and it's already, I think, begun to. The Senate has come out with their jobs plan. Doesn't look like it would create any jobs, but at least it's called a jobs plan.
In other news this week, in a military crackdown on the streets of Cairo, 24 Egyptian Christians protesting an attack on a church were killed.
They started firing gunshots and they started attacking the demonstrators. They were attacked brutally by the military police, pushed back, and then I witnessed two armored vehicles chasing down the street in both directions at an unbelievable speed.
An afternoon adventure turned scary for a Massachusetts family on Tuesday when they got lost in a corn maze. It started to get dark. They called 911.
You're going to be okay, all right?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, all right?
Never again. We thought this would be fun. Instead, it's a nightmare.
The corn maze nightmare. And CEO Mike Lazaridis apologized on YouTube for a big BlackBerry smartphone service outage.
I apologize for the service outages this week. We've let many of you down. But let me assure you that we're working round the clock to fix this.
Yeah, we're looking at a week in the news. No to the jobs bill, a Herman Cain surge in the GOP field. The U.S. alleges an Iran terror plot in the U.S. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, is here. Major Garrett from National Journal joins us, and our own Jack Beatty. You can jump in. What do you make of the Iran terror plot allegations? Does that sound for real? Does Occupy Wall Street have legs? Where is it headed? What do you make of the riot and crackdown in Egypt? 11 years in jail for hedge fund billionaire Raj Rajaratnam. The BlackBerry's blackout. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Karen, here's Newton online, says, Karen Tumulty did the best job I've seen at a presidential debate, and I've been watching since 1960. She was prepared, not just with initial questions, but follow-up. He's all for you, Karen.
Oh, I thank you very much.
Here.
Kind words are very much appreciated.
Here's Scott in Jamestown, New York, says, 999, are you kidding me? In New York, we pay over 7% sales tax already. Added on 16%, maybe no big deal for somebody, but with a trust fund, but it is for him. Bill writes, he must be channeling Herman Cain there, let them eat pizza. David's calling from Orlando, Florida. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are we going to retaliate against Iran without major escalation?
Okay, let's look at Iran. And this whole scenario this week, Karen, I'll come first to you on this one. I mean, this just, it seemed so out of the blue, such a wild story, a plan to allegedly to go after the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C., maybe in a favorite restaurant, blow up a lot of other people with him, have it done by a Mexican drug dealer, an Iranian-American used car salesman setting this all up, and allegedly, again, with ties to the Quds Force, kind of special forces, actually in Iran. We'll get to fallout, but where does this come from, Karen?
You know, I really don't know, you know, what to make of this because you know, it does seem somewhat out of character for the, you know, what everything we've known about the Iranians, that, you know, they would have essentially put this entire plot, you know, relied on a guy who apparently, according to the reports, can't even match his socks. So I think we have a lot more to learn about this. But, the government is saying that the evidence was very credible, that it was backed up with significant assets. And, you know, the Obama administration is promising that there will be serious, you know, there will be some, Iran is going to have to pay for this.
Major Garrett, I mean, the president doubling down on this yesterday, he's called for the toughest sanctions, quoting him here. That's different, I guess, than military intervention. But still, he said American officials, quoting him, know that he had direct links, was paid by and directed by individuals in the Iranian government. I mean, they're coming all barrels blazing here on this, Major, but yet there seems to be a lot of skepticism out in the world.
The burden will be on the administration to disclose what it can publicly to authenticate this alleged plot, and then give everything else it has that it can't release publicly, but will probably show up in leaked cables maybe 2 or 3 years from now privately to foreign governments around the world, particularly in two places, in Europe and in Jordan, Turkey. I would say principally those two, and when Egypt gets together a government worth trusting. Because why do I say Europe? Because for sanctions to really work, the UN is a very difficult body in which to do that. You can achieve them, but it's very slow going. It's very grinding. If this information is shared with European governments and European governments take on unilateral sanctions of the kind that would limit both commercial interaction with Iran and tourist interaction with Iran, I know that sounds very sort of gauzy and insignificant, but I've in all my conversations with those who deal with the Iran issue and deal with Europe, the commerce and the tourism between those two places are profoundly important to individual Iranians. And you change that, you limit access to Europe, you deny access commercial and otherwise to Europe, that will get Iranian people's attention, and that will put pressure on the government. But historically, the Europeans have been very unwilling to do this. Now, in the region itself, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, and the Turks have to look at this in a completely different way, that Iran, if this case is actually true, would go to the nth degree and assassinate a Saudi ambassador in the United States, trying to destabilize among the single most important relationships in the globe between Saudi Arabia and another nation. And they will have to persuade those countries that this is of a different character, and Iran has to be dealt with differently than it has before. I just don't think, as the caller indicated, that military action is likely, because it is extremely complicated and carries with it enormous risks. Other things are going to have to be negotiated in Europe and in the region.
Jack, you know, here's Iran looking out on the world, its big ally in the Middle East, Syria, in all kinds of unstable trouble right now. And all kinds of talk about power struggles within Iran. So maybe they've got their reasons. Then you hear skepticism in this country. You know, Jerry says, oh, this looks like a dodge, a distraction. Back in the day, Bush administration, when things like this came up, people very often pointed and said, hey, they're just trying to distract from, you know, X, Y, or Z. How are you looking at this? On the other hand, Jack, the last thing you want is for something to blow up in the middle of Washington with a whole lot of people in, including the Saudi ambassador. How are you looking at this?
Well, I'm struck with what Iran specialists quoted in the press have said, people like Gary Sick at Columbia, who says this just doesn't fit any known pattern that he's seen of Iranian espionage, intelligence, terrorism, call it what you will. And he can't see a motive for what really would be an act of war. To blow up a building in someone else's country would be an act of war. Why? What would be the gain for it? And then when you look at Karen brought out the dubious quality of the key suspect, his unreliability, his lack of political involvement, he just doesn't seem like a likely linchpin here. But then when you also look at the source, the FBI plant in the drug cartel that he's talking to, I mean, how do we know about this person? What do we know about him? Could this be another curveball? Remember him? He was the guy that said, "Oh yeah, for Saddam has weapons of mass destruction," and that didn't pan out. And we also know that this man has been trying to get off a rap. He was somehow convicted of drug trafficking here, and to get out of his rap, he's been informing, and this is his what he's come up with. So there are just reasons to doubt it. Now, I heard Dianne Feinstein of the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman saying, yep, we've looked at the evidence, it's there. But, you know, she said the same thing about the Iraq war. She voted for it. And the Intelligence Committee saw that evidence, too. And then, you know, there's just the ironies of this that people, the Los Angeles Times has even pointed out that, you know, this is a plot to kill people on someone else's territory and with a kind of indifference to collateral damage. Well, of course, what are we doing in the tribal areas of Pakistan? We're going after people who are threatening us with a seeming indifference to collateral damage there. So there are just a lot of aspects of it that trouble me, and that, more importantly, trouble experts on Iran.
Clearly plenty of skepticism. On the other hand, nobody wants to see a hall full of dead in Washington, D.C., that's for sure. Yusuf in Buffalo, New York. Yusuf, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because my comment was just to kind of refresh everybody's memory about a lot of allegations, at least domestically, against the Arab and Muslim community of the FBI entrapping a lot of perhaps mentally disturbed individuals who haven't quite reached the level of violence that would entail allegations of terrorism. But a lot of times the FBI agents undercover will perhaps egg certain people on or give them ideas. In this instance, I had read briefly that the agent that's been cited in the Eric Holder's draft was the one who actually suggested doing the wire transfer. And it just seems that the Obama administration has this pattern and of disregarding a lot of perhaps playing it by the rules in order to kind of prop up certain people as terror threats when they aren't as serious of a threat as they normally would be. for the purpose of perhaps, I guess, getting everybody scared or getting everybody to jump on board?
Yusuf, we've got it. And I mean, there certainly have been so many cases now. You wonder just how many federal agents are out there and about. Every time somebody, you know, utters, gosh darn the USA, there seems to be somebody there at their elbow. On the other hand, nobody wants an attack in this country. Douglas in Sioux City, Iowa. Douglas, you're on the air.
Hello. I think that the world suffers less from unanswered questions than it suffers from unquestioned answers.
Okay.
And I think this whole deal has a put-up smell to it. It's another weapons of mass destruction. It's another purchase of yellow cake. And it seems strange to me that every time one of these little plots against the United States turns out to be an FBI agent has sat in a bar with some nitwit and talked him into coming up with some outrageous plan. This whole thing sounds so stupid that we would have to think that the Iranians are idiots to try and pull it off. I think that some idiots in our government thinks it's awful smart to think they have a point where they can help support their arguments with to sustain the drug war and the war on terrorism. And I think that we should get fed up with this and start asking questions about these answers that we're given.
Douglas, we've got it, and we'll have a chance to do that. I mean, they're saying they're going to lay it all out. Everybody's going to be able to see. So, yeah, it would take some chutzpah, but there is chutzpah. Let's go to Christian, Norwalk, Connecticut. Christian, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm another one of the voices that really just doesn't believe a word of it. And most telling is the recent UN vote on the Palestinian state issue. You know, the United States voted against the Saudis' interests, so they started to push them away, and now we very easily bring them back in the fold with a half-baked terrorist plot that was going to kill one of their ambassadors to the United States, and it's kind of twofold. It gets them back on our side, and it gets them back on our side on the anti-Iranian issue. So take that, coupled with the history of the United States government with weapons of mass destruction, the provocation for war in Iraq, which turned out to not be true, Gulf of Tonkin.
Christian, we've got it, and we're getting history there at the same time. Wow, Karen, listen to that solid wall of skepticism on, you know, a story that on the face of it, and again, there's ask questions, and indeed, but on the face of it, nobody would want to see this kind of attack. But listen to that skepticism, Karen. It's remarkably high.
Well, and I do think it's because there's just, you know, so much of this that looks like a Peter Sellers movie. But again, I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on the government to come out with a little more about what exactly was happening here. And another thing that we haven't really talked about much is, what are the Saudis going to do about this?
Mm-hmm. They're sitting right there next to Iran. There's going to be more to come on that, if I may. I want to just scoot back to something else for a second here. The Senate jabbing at China this week on its alleged currency manipulation, which has a big trade impact and big trade deals this week. Let's listen to Mitt Romney for just a second again at the debate on Tuesday night, saying he would take a hard line on what he described as China's currency manipulation.
When people have pursued unfair trade practices, you have to have a president that will take action. And on day one, I've indicated day one, I will issue an executive order identifying China as a currency manipulator. We'll bring an action against them in front of the WTO for manipulating their currency, and we will go after them. Yep. If you're not willing to stand up to China, you'll get run over by China, and that's what's happened for 20 years.
Major Garrett, connect the dots here for us, if you can. Mitt Romney on China with a very tough line there, some Senate action this week. On the other side of the ledger, three pretty substantial free trade agreements that have been waiting for a long time, quite a big one with South Korea. What's that picture, Major?
Quickly, and I would say, Tom, I'm usually very comfortable using the word alleged, but there's no alleged currency manipulation. China manipulates its currency. It admits as much.
Yeah.
And what I thought was interesting about Mitt Romney's declaration there, it sounded so tough, but an executive order by a president doesn't change legislation. It doesn't empower U.S. companies, as this legislation in the Senate that passed would, to seek countervailing duties or higher tariffs against Chinese products. And a WTO process is lengthy and very time-consuming. Both, of course, lengthy and time-consuming.
Right.
Yes. Redundant. And what Romney didn't say, which I thought he should have said if he really is going to be this tough, is if I were president right now, I would do what President Obama is not doing. I would say I would sign that legislation, and I would urge the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, to bring it to a vote. And John Boehner won't bring it to a vote. He opposes it, even though there are 225 co-sponsors in the House and 175 signatories of a discharge petition. If you get 218 signatures on a discharge petition, you can bring something to the House floor. This issue is going to continue to percolate, even though House Speaker Boehner is putting a hand on trying to suffocate the issue and the administration is sort of dancing around it. This issue is going to return. And what's interesting is it's coming along right alongside a moment when we are, as you mentioned, expanding free trade with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. Those trade deals passed by enormous margins, mm-hmm. far larger than any trade deal since NAFTA. That, I think, is a significant political turning point.
Karen, free trade with those three and trade war with China? Or is this more a talking point than an action point?
Well, actually, that answer by Governor Romney was to a question I had asked, which mm-hmm. is, you know, the fact is that we have heard a number of presidential candidates talk tough on China, and two of them were George W. Bush and Barack Obama, only to see them once they get into office take a much more cautious line, you know, in part because this is a very complicated relationship and in part because, you know, China holds so much of our debt.
Yeah, and Jack,
Bill Clinton talked tough, well, too, as well.
He did, but, you know, I think this is not about China. I think it's about Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. This is talk that's going to go over big there. And I think Governor Romney really has gotten to President Obama's left on trade.
Yeah, and it's all, of course, at the end about jobs. Major Garrett says he sees a kind of resonance with Occupy Wall Street right around the country. He takes it all the way back to Marvin Gaye. We'll go out with Marvin Gaye and your Inner City Blues. Make me want to holler, Garrett. This one's for you, Major.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for being with us today. Karen Tumulty with The Washington Post. Always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, make me want to holler. We'll give it to you too, Jack. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Trigger happy, only sin. Panic is spreading. God knows where we're headed. Oh.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.